Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and today is a gloomy, sort of hailing, sleeting Sunday in Brooklyn, but in a couple days, it'll be Valentine's Day, which is the biggest day for roses, perhaps, and buying chocolate. So there's actually no denying that there's an association between chocolate and feelings of lust. And I'm really excited to mention a little tidbit, because last week we were talking about oysters, and there was a tidbit from the book about how Casanova, the Venetian 18th century traveler, had eaten copious amounts of oysters to get into the mood, if you will. And in the book I'm holding right now, there is also a mention of Casanova eating copious amounts of chocolate for the same exact reason. So the book I'm holding right now is Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love by Simran Sethi. But we already had this show last year on Valentine's Day when Simran came in. But however, she has continued to talk and write and speak about chocolate and many other food systems issues and biodiversity. And she has recently launched a new podcast all about chocolate called The Slow Melt. So Simran is joining us again this Valentine's Day episode. And I'm so excited to have you on air. Hi, Simran.
Hi, Kathy. Great to be back.
Yeah, thanks for joining us again. And it's been quite a year. So you've been, you know, talking about the subjects explored in your book and beyond for the last year or so. You've also been a contributor for many other publications throughout the years. You've done, you've been an environmental correspondent for NBC News. You anchored a PBS Quest series on science and sustainability. So it's really interesting that you decided to dedicate a podcast all about chocolate, The Slow Melt, just recently. Congrats,
you know,
by the way.
For me, it's so interesting because everything comes together in chocolate. And I mean, a handful of years ago, I wouldn't have realized this, but it's, you know, through this thick, delicious lens, we can look at environmental issues. We can look at sustainability. We can look at economics, history, identity, deliciousness, sexiness. I mean, the list goes on and on. And when I, you know, when I was writing the book, I decided to tell the story of, you know, agricultural biodiversity and changes in food and agriculture through bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer. And, you know, through the research and interviewing people, you know, I was like, oh my goodness. One of the people I interviewed said, we have loved chocolate our entire lives. And that kind of relationship is so different than one that's learned. And for me, you know, chocolate is something I reach for when I'm sad. I reach for when I'm happy. I celebrate birthdays, my wedding cake, my divorce. You know, I not celebrated divorce, but sad divorce. Ate chocolate all the way through. Like,
and bomb.
Then this kind of, life thread. So I thought, why not embrace that and talk about stories through something that people already love?
Mm-hmm. I love your first episode, which is up right now. I should mention the podcast, The Slow Melt, is on KCRW LA's public radio. And you can listen to the first episode. But there's so much
actually,
to cover.
Let me jump in and correct you. I wish it were on KCRW.
Oh, sorry. Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry.
A segment was excerpted. Like, a segment of an interview I've done for the podcast is available on a program that launched yesterday on KCRW. But The Slow Melt is on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, through all your traditional podcast outlets and also through the Public Radio Exchange.
Got it. Okay. Thanks for clarifying. But it's a wonderful podcast, and I love the diversity of topics that it sounds like you're going to cover for the whole series. The first episode was all about the diversity of flavor compounds and how to taste chocolate, which is a really great, sort of, I'm not like a chocolate, professional chocolate taster, but that was a really accessible and really fascinating episode. So there's so much to cover. And I mean, while we're on the topic of sexiness, though, I have to mention that I was looking through the Bread, Wine, Chocolate again. Not only is there discussion of Casanova, but there's also the Aztecs who invented chocolate. And there is it's believed that they ritualistically ate cacao off of each other's skin during sex.
You know, this is all legend, but it's really it's one that I embrace, and so it's been really
thanks,
exciting
David.
To realize like how much. And there's new research that's come out. I can't give you the details; they're just fuzzy. But that cacao, which is the seed that becomes chocolate, you know, was also used as a stand-in for blood during human rituals.
Okay.
And I want to explore that further, but it again all ties into this sort of like the way it looked once it was roasted. And I think those sensations that it elicits, you know, and it's because, I mean, it really is like a chemical thing. Cocoa has flavonoids, which are known for their, you know, antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties. It has theobromine, which kind of perks us up like coffee, you know, and anandamide, which drops us back down. Mm-hmm. And then it has tryptophan in it, which is used by our bodies to make serotonin. And, you know, serotonin is a neurotransmitter that helps regulate our moods and sexual function. And so those things are all sort of like, it's like almost like the food is conspiring with us, you know, to bring us joy and perk us up. And then it has phenylethylamine, which is known as PEA. And it's also been called the love drug. And it's sort of stimulates that euphoria of, you know, falling in love. So to put it all together, and chocolate's kind of the total package.
And it's good for you too, the antioxidants. I mean, and we're talking, okay, so if I eat like a 99-cent bar of whatever, Cadbury cream egg chocolate, or a piece of that, I'm not getting as much cacao, right?
Okay, first of all, cream egg is not really chocolate, you know, Easter's one of those big chocolate holidays. So we've got Valentine's, Halloween, and Easter. It's like we're in the middle of chocolate season, but those cocoa-rich pieces of chocolate do. You know, the more cocoa content, the more opportunities for all this, the kind of health benefits to emerge. But, you know, you don't need to, I mean, most candy bars, you know, have like 9-10% cocoa in them. And that's all you need to be called like a chocolate bar, but they're not going to have what you find in like a 70% bar or something with a higher cocoa percentage.
Okay. So tip out there, if anyone wants to really feel the effects, go for the higher percentage. Cause the other ones might not. Might just make you feel full.
Pro tip, if you're eating chocolate for health, like, you know, I don't know, maybe you could just like not do that. maybe let this be your indulgence and enjoy it for that. You know, I feel like there doesn't have to be a virtue halo on everything. Like, there's really a lot of meaning to like savoring and loving something, and that also being okay, especially for Valentine's Day, you know?
Well, you've eaten a lot of chocolate in your time, and you seem to be pretty healthy. So I'm encouraged by that.
Exactly. And you know, this is another thing. Like, I will say one big tip. If anyone's trying to like go the healthy route with chocolate and choosing one of these weird like low fat chocolates, like really don't do it, because the cocoa bean is about 50% fat. Like, cocoa butter isn't dairy butter. It's part of the constitution of the cocoa bean, and all the aromas, which is, you know, the dominant part of what we kind of call this experience of flavor, it's all held in the fat. So it's the same thing with cheese. It's like, you don't want to eat a low-fat cheese. It's like, that's where all the good stuff is. Like, don't
take away
point.
Fat.
Yeah. You know? Like, just eat a little less of it. So that's, you know, and I know, like, eating a little less sounds like, you know, a folly. But I really believe, like, if you're going to go there, like, go for the maximum experience, you know, and stripping away fat from these really amazing things is just, like, it's just dulling everything.
And learned in your podcast, you know, let it melt in your tongue before, you know, so you can savor the flavor, experience it more, and stretch it out. And
exactly. Science, too. That's not even just me. That's not just conjecture. It's really, I spoke with a German economist, and he talks about, there's a chemical process called Strecker degradation. And when you just like chew it up and swallow it quickly, it's not that, that can't unfold. So by letting chocolate melt on your tongue, you know, it's going up into your system, into the, you know, back into the retronasal passage. It's, you know, the Strecker degradation is allowed to happen. Like everything is released. And so it's just, you know, I mean, if you're going to spend the money and the calories, like, why not, you know, do it right?
Why not? So, or if you're like the Aztecs, you could let it melt on your sex partner's body.
Why not? Even if not.
I'm not sure what that does health-wise, but okay. So, okay, a lot of people are going to be buying chocolate, and you recently wrote a piece for the Washington Post a couple of days ago, actually, about all the labels out there. So Kraft, what the heck does that mean? And single origin, quality, bean to bar, these terms that we hear thrown around. Let's talk a little bit about that. Like, how can I know, what the heck is Kraft mean? How can I know that, you know, that's ensuring some sort of higher standard or level of quality or process that's different?
Right. So this is such an interesting question. And I was really, I mean, just to give a little context, about a year ago, there was this controversy, you know, around these producers out in Brooklyn, Mass Brothers. They were making chocolate. And all of a sudden there was this big, like, uproar because they weren't making it, all of their chocolate. Some of it they were, but from the bean, right? So if you're making chocolate from the bean, you're shelling it, you're grinding it, you're roasting it. Like, it's a big process. It's the difference between making a cake from like a Duncan Hines mix or something versus like making it from scratch.
Yeah.
Like, you both made a cake, but they're very different. So a lot of people were upset because they were making it from a pre-made couverture.
Or did at one point in time, and then they like...
Exactly, yeah, at one
just
point. Exactly.
Ballooned
but that
from
they,
there.
That, you know, allegedly, you know, there, that there wasn't a lot of transparency around it.
Yeah.
Now, for
right.
me, as a journalist, it's like, okay, well, most people don't even know, like, what the difference is. But what I'm concerned about is that all of a sudden we're supposed to understand this and be mad about it, and no one ever really knew what it meant, you know? And so I started, like, madly interviewing people, chocolate makers, farmers, purveyors, about 50 people, to ask them this question, like, what is Kraft chocolate? Fast forward a year, and I write this piece for the Washington Post, because we're no closer to a universal answer about what this is. And I want buyers to understand this as they're going in and making this investment and trying to understand, like, hey, do they like Kraft chocolate or not? Like, let's be clear, there is no standardized definition. So every bar has a potential to be different. So it's really worthwhile doing a little bit of research, asking the people if you're in a specialty chocolate shop what they think. You know, if you're just like in a regular, you know, supermarket or grocery store or whatever, like paying attention, maybe picking up your phone, doing a quick Google search. Like, get a little knowledge about what you're doing, because some people have been making Kraft chocolate for a handful of months, some for, you know, well over a decade. Like, this is still an emerging, evolving industry, but because the packaging tends to be so beautiful, people, myself, we as humans, are really swayed. So, you know, a term like bean to bar is like the new, like, I don't know, buzz term, but, you know, that really just means that you've had oversight from the bean to the bar. And, I mean, of course, every big chocolate manufacturer has had that same kind of oversight. And I can see that, the one I hang on that a lot, because I can see it going the way of GMO. You know, like, then all of a sudden, you know, it's like genetic engineering is one thing, genetic modification seems to be another, and then people get confused, and you have big agriculture saying, well, everything's genetically modified, and then, you know, which is indeed true. So then, you know, that's kind of the, I mean, that's the cornerstone of agriculture.
Yeah.
We're always trying to improve what we're growing and breeding. And so for me, I just think it's really important to be clear on those terms. Like, there is, what does artisanal mean? Does it mean someone hand wrapped something? Does it mean they use traditional methods to process the chocolate? Like, where are
they? Does it mean that you have a beard?
Sorry.
Okay, that you have a beard. I'm just kidding.
Yes, exactly. And you know, like, where your chocolate was made, because cocoa comes from a thin band around the equator, right? It didn't start with some bearded hipsters in Brooklyn. It started with 90% grown by subsistence farmers, you know, and 70% of cocoa is grown in West Africa. So, like, let's give a little reverence to these, like, really poor farmers in places like Ivory Coast and Ghana who have grown this cocoa, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, so, you know, when you see a single origin bar, that's, you know, that's a word that is actually more easy to grasp than something like craft or whatever, artisanal.
Right. Absolutely.
I think, well, that's obviously to kind of demonstrate the different flavor profiles of this terroir, of this type of bean, which sounds like that would be coming from a maker who puts a lot of care in it. Is that a good sort of general feeling? Because, you know, even if the word single origin, it sounds like this isn't really a regulated thing. Like, you could probably say single origin and get away with not being single origin, but it seems like that's a good kind of marker of a maker who is doing something for taste and so forth.
I just wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal, and I love the trend of single origin is really trying to express that place matters, right? That these beans came from somewhere, not nowhere. And that is a distinction between what we call commodity cocoa, right? So the definition of a commodity is it's kind of like, it's fungible. That's an economic term that means it's interchangeable. So, like, wheat from Kansas is no different than wheat from, you know, some other place in the Midwest, which is no different from, you know, and cocoa from I don't know, you know, Ghana is no different than cocoa from Ecuador and what have you. And so, like, what single origin is trying to say is, like, there is terroir, there is a taste of place in these cocoa beans, and we want to express it and recognize it and draw out those flavors. Right. Now, right now, the origin designation tends to be just like country, you know, that it's very broad, right? And within a country, you will have, I mean, hundreds of different flavors. Just like in coffee, we get farm specific. But with cocoa, in order to properly ferment cocoa, you need like a significant amount of beans. So oftentimes, because people are producing, you know, growing smaller lots of cocoa, they get mixed together. So we haven't gotten that kind of micro specificity that we might see. There certainly could be more detail than we're finding right now, but for the most part, you'll see like Ecuador or Venezuela.
Right.
And so we have these broad brushstrokes of kind of
Ethiopia.
What those flavors mean. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a lot more about this. I want to talk about the origins of cacao, where it's grown and where it's going to be in the future, right after a quick little commercial break.
And this one is called Casanova by Tom Cruise. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hey, hey, we're chatting more with Simran Sethi. She is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, and also the host of the new podcast, The Slow Melts, Exploring Chocolate. So, Simran, hi. You still with us?
Hi.
All right.
Oh, gosh, I'm like off in cheese land now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dreaming of Wisconsin. That's
and
thanks, awesome.
Yeah, thanks for the Casanova musical interlude, David, by the way. Our engineer is having fun with us.
Tom Cruise, thank you.
Yeah. Yep. So it was really funny when I mentioned that, you know, when we're chatting about having you back on the show for Valentine's Day because we could talk about chocolate, I think it was really funny that you were like, oh, it's perfect because it's also Black History Month and chocolate.
Yeah.
There's so many things to talk about with chocolate with that. I was like, really? But then you went on to say, you know, how a lot of the cacao today is grown in Africa. Tell us a little bit more about that. Because it used to be, it's a South American product. It's native to South America, right?
So the kind of the center of origin, which is the place where cocoa was born, is this kind of bean-shaped area crossing Ecuador and Peru and up into Colombia. It's an Amazonian product. But mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people don't know, and this is exactly the same thing with coffee, right? We think about coffee, and most of us think, conjure up like...
Aztecs.
I don't know if you remember these commercials, but there were these Juan Valdez commercials, right?
Okay.
I think it comes from Colombia. So coffee was born in Ethiopia. Mm. And, you know, the kind of the flip of that is, while chocolate was born in South America, and it was domesticated, it became chocolate in Central America. So we, you know, it's a really sort of Latin American product. The place where it comes from now is West Africa. Uh-huh. 70% of our cocoa comes from West Africa, 45% of it just from two countries, from Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Wow.
And I think it's really important, yeah, to realize, and this isn't an area that had like a culinary tradition,
yeah,
or, you know, everything we were talking about earlier with the Aztecs and, you know, even with the Maya, like there was no historical connection to cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's evolving in real time. And one of the things I wrote about in this story that I was mentioning on Origin is this emerging trend to make chocolate in the countries where it's grown. And so, you know, to me, this is a social justice issue. Historically, you know, all these products, these commodities are grown in the global south, and then they're shipped to the global north,
right,
and that's
right
where most of the money is made. You know,
mm-hmm,
the coffee beans are roasted.
So the raw materials are... Yeah, shipped off to be processed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And with chocolate, it's the same thing, right? Like most people, when they think of chocolate, the person who comes to mind or the company is like,
Dandelion,
I don't know,
or
maybe
whatever,
one sitting in Hershey,
yeah,
Pennsylvania,
okay,
or a shop up, you know, up in Brooklyn. Like there's not a lot of awareness of the hands that have touched it before that point. So for me, this really is like about reclaiming like the role, the centrality of Africa in some of the foods and drinks that we really love deeply, you know, and have mm-hmm. no real, maybe don't have a lot of awareness of.
Yeah. Do you see any efforts to kind of create more integrated, I don't know, is it possible to have, you know, a fully integrated, I don't know if this is a naive thought, like maker who also is close to the growers,
yes,
or is the same.
That's what
I don't know.
Yes. And that's what I love so much because it really changes the paradigm. If there are a lot of people consuming that chocolate in the place where it's grown,
yeah,
you're having that immediate feedback,
yeah,
first of all, from the consumers. And it's really, you know, one of my favorite interviews we've done so far for the Slow Melt is with Jillian Goddard. She's a farmer in Trinidad. And she talks about, it's on show two, she talks about how, you know, like what it means for the identity of the farmer. That, like, historically, farmers are still have lower status than someone like a chocolate maker. And so for these farmers in her community to actually not only grow the cocoa, but actually go so far as to become small cocoa chocolate makers has really kind of transformed how they're perceived.
Yeah.
So I think even if you don't have those things happening interchangeably, like farmer becoming maker, what you see is a real kind of shift in sort of what it means to grow the product, because it's something that there does seem to have more pride in,
yes,
kind of producing,
mm-hmm,
and that these chocolates that are being produced are, you know, they're world-class chocolates. We're talking about some, like, I mean, my favorite makers are makers from places of origin, like,
right,
Cacao Hunters in Colombia, Maru in Vietnam. Like, I mean, these chocolates are fantastic, and they're employing people locally, they're keeping money in the local economy, and they're helping those farmers who are there better understand, like, what happens to that crop that they grow.
So you can bask.
It becomes something,
yeah,
magical that they now have a much closer relationship to.
And they can take part in basking in the glory of, you know, when it wins an award, say, at a fancy chocolate competition. It's really weird to have, you know, no participation in that, I guess, you know,
yeah,
as we're tasting.
That's
in
changing, too. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there's an amazing effort that's being led called Cocoa of Excellence. It's analogous to what happens in coffee with this initiative called Cup of Excellence, and it really is meant to reward the farmer. Like, we have all these great chocolate contests, you know, the International Chocolate Awards, the Good Food Awards, that are giving credit to the makers, but what the Cocoa of Excellence program is doing is actually rewarding the farmers.
The growers.
And the hope, of course, is that recognition will help them be able to charge more for that crop, which is exactly what happens with Cup of Excellence. You know,
yes,
those become award-winning coffees that go on to be sold at a price premium. So So hopefully that same thing will happen now with Cocoa of Excellence.
That's fantastic. And you see that going hand in hand with the food movement, you know, exalting the farmers who actually grew it, not just the chefs who prepared it. So I think that's a really cool trend, and I'd love to learn more about. Also, what's going on with this impending chocolate shortage or cacao shortage in the world? Everybody got all alarmed last year.
I'm working on a story right now that I've entitled "Too Much Chocolate, Too Little Chocolate." That's the rough title, right?
Okay.
Because this is folly. I mean, in the sense of just like, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, we were hearing like chocolate is the end is near, right? The end times for chocolate.
Yeah.
Chocageddon, all this
prices
stuff.
Prices are going to start skyrocket. Yeah.
Today, it's in the paper literally today. Yay, chocolate prices. We have too much chocolate. Chocolate prices are at historic lows. Yay, guys, buy more chocolate. You know, celebrate. This is awesome. And I want to take it back to the farmer again, because this is the opposite of awesome. You know, what we saw before, first of all, with this notion of the world running out of chocolate, I want to address first. With climate change, we're going to see a lot of changes in chocolate. But that sort of that model was based on a very, a clear trajectory of consumption in places like Asia, right? So the idea was like, woo, you know, the Indians, Simran's people, and, you know, we're going to start eating massive amounts of chocolate, and all of a sudden the world's going to run out of chocolate, you know, because China and India are going to just, like, their demand is going to grow exponentially. Well, it grew, but it didn't grow exponentially, and it's kind of leveled. And meanwhile, we're seeing a little bit, you know, that same kind of flatness in North America and in Europe. So that didn't happen. And then we had, you know, some really wonderful harvests where there was an abundance of cocoa, which, you know, I mean, I've always found this really weird that, like, farmers doing their job and then the Mother Nature cooperating results in a bumper crop and then the price drops, right? And so it's almost like you're being rewarded for doing everything right, but you're being punished, I should say, for doing everything right. So now what we find is an oversupply in West Africa.
Oh, geez.
And because the prices were set earlier on these contracts to farmers and were set at higher prices because they assumed there was going to be less of a supply, some people are backing out of those contracts, which is leaving even more cocoa just sitting at the port. So the price is dropping. Now, if you're already a farmer at the margins and that price is going even lower, I mean, you're talking about, like, just to give, like, some sense of perspective, when we spend a buck on a candy bar or a chocolate bar, about 3 to 6 cents goes back to the farmer, right? About 50% goes back to the manufacturer. But you're talking about a tiniest sliver going back. And so this volatility isn't, like, full of joy. This doesn't make me happy. The price is already too low, frankly, for chocolate, and to see it dropping further because of this now oversupply, I just think is something we shouldn't be celebrating. And I think it's really important. I was speaking to the head economist at the International Cocoa Organization on Friday, and he was saying, you know, those stories were quite, like, we kept saying, like, please don't do that. Like, that's not the case. You know, it's not that dramatic. And so, storytellers, you know, we have something to do with that when we kind of go to that extreme of saying, like, danger, you know, it's disappearing. Like, that wasn't exactly true.
Yeah.
It was a lot of economic modeling, and then it kind of, you know,
maybe just to show how much people love chocolate that, you know, they're so alarmist when things like this happens. It goes around and around. Well, thank you.
And I get it. Like, we want to try to make people understand climate change is real, right? So it's hard to talk about an abstract. But if you say, like, hey, guys, your coffee and your chocolate are going to disappear, of course there are models that show us this stuff. And I myself have said stuff that's a little bit like, hey, this is going to go away if we don't do something.
Right,
true, but it's not like imminent tomorrow, you know? And I think that's maybe where things got a little bit out of hand and have resulted in something that's really tricky for farmers now.
Hey, well, if it's a gateway to kind of understanding the complexities more behind cacao and so forth, that's great. And I love that you're going to explore this more and share with us, too, soon. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that article.
Thank you. Yeah, it'll be an article, and we'll have, I think I'm so eager to talk about this now. I think show number 4 of the Slow Melt will be dedicated to these economics and helping all of us understand this, because it's not just exclusive to cocoa, right? Every time you hear about these things, this is, I want us to kind of understand and have revealed what these booms and busts really mean in terms of like what we eat and the people who grow what we eat.
Should I look to fair trade as being helpful in determining, who's, is that a helpful label, would you say, at this point?
All these certifications and, I hate to keep saying like, and then it'll be on the show again, but it really will. dedicated to this, of course, which is because, I want consumers to be informed and empowered, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like we're operating in this vacuum and it's really unfair and uncool. And without this knowledge, we can't make good decisions. And so we're plunking down money for something that may or may not be very delicious. And so what kind of like what can help us when it comes to certifications? There is, of course, oversight here. But if you're looking for the most, flavorful varieties of chocolate, they may not necessarily be certified. So what I want people to remember is, like, when it comes to fair trade, it's an economic instrument, right? Mm-hmm. Its intention is to ensure that farmer cooperatives are paid a fair wage for the cocoa that they grow. And that is a wonderful thing. And in the absence of all other information, I think certifications are a great way to know that, like, someone cares about something, and there is something to be said for that. But I also really like the emerging trend in this, ill-defined craft chocolate movement of makers really having those more direct relationships with farmers. And for lack of a kind of a better term, what we see in coffee is the direct trade movement. And so I'm going to use that term here as well, which is just there are smaller cocoa brokers that are actually working directly with farmers to help improve their post-harvest techniques and to help them get a fair price for their cocoa beans, but they may not be the same kinds of certifications that you've heard of. They may not be OOTS or Rainforest Alliance or Fair Trade, but they're a different quality of relationship. And, at the end of the day, we're trusting these makers and manufacturers. We're putting what they make in our bodies. And so I would like to believe in that relationship and foster those a little bit more deeply. And there's some great chocolate makers out there that are really, Dandelion, for example, out in San Francisco has created a sourcing report. Wow. And you can look and see where every one of their cocoas comes from. And they're beautiful stories, really like great consumer information, gorgeous photos, helping us to understand like the bigger story of the farm. Taza Chocolate does the same thing. I love what they're doing and how they've also supported farmers. So there's some companies, Askanosi, these are ones that are really committed to helping consumers, chocolate eaters and lovers also feel that connection all the way back to the farm. Mm-hmm. So, that's something to look for. If that's something you value, that's something to consider as well.
Definitely. And it shows that, they're trying their best to create the best product, I would say, to work so high touch with those farmers and so forth. So,
it's so interesting. In my coffee chapter in the book, there's a gentleman named Peter Giuliano, and he says, coffee that is made without this kind of attention and care isn't great coffee. Like, and what he was getting at was this idea that like the relationships are what make it delicious and great. Mm-hmm. And I really believe in that. Like the construct of flavor is really malleable. It depends on the lighting, the shape of the bowl, who we're with. There's so many things that influence how we experience something, but part of that is the story. And for me, that's a critical part because I want to know that the kinds of things that I'm eating have been made, with care and consideration for all the people through the supply chain, who are helping us get that glorious cup of coffee or that wonderful bar of chocolate or whatever it is.
I feel like we've come full circle. Now, relationships are the thing that makes great chocolate so great.
And the relationship we have with it, the slow melt. How we relate to it in our mouth.
I'm still thinking about those Aztecs though. Anyway, I guess that's about all the time we have for today, but I can't wait to keep listening and reading your work. So everyone check out The Slow Melt, which you can listen to on iTunes, Stitcher. Just check it out. You'll find Simran Sethi's lovely voice out there. And all right. Well, anything else, Simran, from you?
Kathy, happy Valentine's
Day. Happy Valentine's Day. And happy Valentine's Day, everyone at Heritage. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words. Mm-hmm.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. And I
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.